Welcome back. And I have another guest, another profession. And today is someone from my edge of the woods, advertising. Narayan is a copywriter. At least that's what he started out as. And like most writers I've seen, there is no course that gets you into copywriting. So without further ado, let me bring Narayan on board. Hi, Narayan.
Hi.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey for you. And it's only over the past couple of conversations that we had that I realized that your interests extend not just to writing and to audio, guitars as well. Web design is, of course, something that you completely blew me away with, because when you look at it, writers are not supposed to become geeks. Another one of the unconventional choices you made.
Yeah, maybe my choice of advertising as a profession itself may be a good starting point.
That's a great place to start. Absolutely.
So, like you said, I was doing my MA in economics. And at the end of it, I surprised myself by being the second in the university. But that's a different story. But wow. After I had finished giving the exam and all that, I was not at all clear what I was going to do. I knew that everybody got a job doing something or the other, and therefore I would be doing some job, but I had no clue. In fact, the very reason for doing MA was because I'd finished BA and I had the same problem, and I said, let me study more. And therefore,
I think a lot of us have that problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, these days, of course, people are very different, and probably from the 10th standard onwards, people seem to know why I'm going to become an interior designer or a dentist or whatever it is. They seem to be pretty clear, and that's a nice thing. But in my time, at least, I wasn't that kind, and I had no clue absolutely what I was going to do with myself. A visit to the Connemara Library, it's one of those ancient libraries, and you know, I was walking past it was a legal section or something like that, with all those leather-bound tomes and gathering dust and something like that. I was on my way to somewhere else, but as I was passing by, something caught my eye, and there was this very attractive book hid between those cobwebbed kind of old tomes. And naturally, I saw that and said, what is that doing there? Because it seems some oddball thing standing out. So I pulled it out, and it was a book called The Craft of Copywriting by Alistair Compton. I remember that. I haven't seen that book later. I haven't had heard anybody mention that book, so I don't think it's a great book, or I don't know what it is, but it is not a recognized, it's not certainly David Ogilvy's Confessions or, you know, Birnbach's book or anything like that. So it was some random book, but it was very attractively produced, and it was a Britisher, and I obviously somebody had put it in the deliberately wrong section of the library, because they must have used up their tickets and they must have said, I'll hide it here so that the next time I come, I'll take it from this unlikely place.
Yeah. Yeah.
But unfortunately for them, I was walking at that time, and that very incongruity of that setting caught my eye. So it was probably a wrong move on that guy's part. And therefore, I pulled out that book and I just flipped it through, and there was something nice. I mean, today I know it is the design of the book and the typography and all that. I'm able to say it now. But those days, not just typography and design, I didn't even know what copywriting was. I wasn't sure. I vaguely thought it was that guy who sat under the judge and wrote stuff down or something.
Which is what a lot of people still think copywriters do.
Yeah, I don't know what the connection is. So I was very curious, but it was so attractively laid out. And I said, okay, I think you were allowed to take 3 or 4 books on your tickets those days or something. So I made this as one of the books that I took. And I took it home, and I was there by 5 p.m. And something was so engrossing about that book. I read it over the next 4 or 5 hours, allowing some time for some food and all that. And I finished by 10 o'clock. And by the time I went to sleep, I was so certain that I'm going to become a copywriter. It was that probably that book did its job, honestly. I mean, it's not I've had that kind of some feeling ever again. I've not read or listened to somebody and made some instant decision like that. But it was so clear that, you know, I should be doing something. And I was vaguely thinking, maybe in India, there must be advertising agencies too. And if somebody is willing to pay money for doing this kind of stuff, certainly I can attempt this. This seems to be a nice way to get paid. Then, of course, being in that academic frame of mind, I was thinking, you know, who teaches this stuff? Is there somewhere you need to go? And it so happened that the very next week, my cousin was much older to me. He had a family in Delhi and all that. And just as we were talking, he said that there is a new institute there called the Indian Institute of Mass Communication. It's become pretty famous now. It was in its fledgling days then. And he said that I think they have a course on advertising, but I'll get my secretary to check it out. And if there is something, I'll let you know. So then his secretary checked it out, and then we exchanged mail, meaning what is called snail mail today, actual letters handwritten, and you send it and wait for so many days and all that.
Yeah.
And therefore, he did find out that there was a course like that. And then it was a matter of the next few months, I joined there, basically. So that is how, and that was a nice course because it was conducted, it was coordinated by a professor from inside. And most of the lecturers, practically all the lecturers were from the industry, the advertising industry in Delhi. And some pretty good luminaries were there, copywriters, art people, creative directors, and everybody. And it was nice to know from practitioners, and therefore, you know, you could show the stuff that you created and they'll give you their, you know, very frank appraisals mm-hmm. and so on. So it was quite something to be able to learn, and we spent about 10 months or something in that course. And they gave me some, what is that thing called, scholarship. And I got back all the money that we paid for that course also, which wasn't much. So therefore, and I stayed with my cousin. So therefore, you know, it was a bit of a jolly time. There was nothing for me to
do. Yeah,
I ate, slept in his house and went, caught a bus, and probably my only expense was those bus tickets or something. So therefore, it was all pretty cool. Made some new friends and all that. And from there, of course, it was, I did my internship in Delhi at Ogilvy at that time. It was called Ogilvy, Benson and Mather. Later on, it became Ogilvy and Mather, and then it became
O&M. So what was the process for getting an internship? Was it much simpler then?
It was because the university, our institute wrote to the, they asked us to choose, and me and somebody else, I think, chose Bombay as the place, and he chose Lintas, and I chose Ogilvy. We could both be in Bombay, although in different agencies, we could meet during lunchtime, and because both the offices were in South Mumbai and all that. So that was nice to have somebody there. And therefore, the course director wrote to these people, and it was somewhat simple, I think. I don't know what happened because we were told that, yes, it's been accepted, and we were taking some midnight train from Delhi to Mumbai, and we were there. So I spent a month there, beautiful time. I learned a lot, asked a lot of questions, probably made an ass of myself, but learned a lot. And Mani Iyer, he was the name of that. He's a big doyen of the advertising industry. And he's no more. But, I mean, they were all very, very accomplished people and all that. So you got to meet him on the first day that you went. He spent about 15, 20 minutes with you. And in the last day that you were leaving, he spent again 15, 20 minutes with you. And he also got up to walk with you to this well-furnished, huge cabin. He came up to the door to open the door for you and wish you good luck and all that. Wow. I mean, these are all things that you don't forget decades later.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I mean, we knew that it was some PR thingy at some level, and you know that it was all done. But it is a nice thing. No? They don't need to have done it to trainees and students.
Just one thing. In terms of writing, are you saying that before you read the book, you had never really looked at writing as one of your strengths, or you had explored writing in some form?
Actually, no. I had not written anything. But, you know, one of those vague things like, you know, it's not exactly Dear Diary kind of stuff. But my father used to say, you know, read The Hindu or read The Statesman or read the something which has got quality editorials in it and all that. And half the things you didn't understand because it was all about some war somewhere or some famine in Bihar. And at that time, you didn't know anything much about these things. So you had no particular context, and TV was in its infancy. So therefore, you know, there was not much to read or something. But they were very clear that, no, if you want to write, then write of a certain standard. That much I understood. And therefore, I used to just pick up stuff that interested me and oddball, not continuously, now and then. All told, maybe 20 pieces of some prose I must have written over 2 years. Not in any organized way, not in a, what shall I say, not in some Sunday I will sit down and do this. Not in that sort of, there was no timetable to it. Just a free-flowing thing. But barring that, I was not the guy, you know, like people say, I have a book inside me and all. I was not that guy. I didn't write poetry. I didn't write short stories, or I didn't write, I didn't submit anything for, you know, to magazines or newspapers or stuff like that. But yet, when I read that book, I felt that I could be doing that. So
it's quite a leap. Okay, so you finished your internship at Ogilvy and then looked for a job straight away, or?
No. I went back to Delhi to complete the next 2 months of the course that was there.
Okay.
And then, since I had my elder brother in Bombay, who during the internship told me, come here, Bombay is the place in whatever field you want. And he was right. And you have my house. So again, I got food and residence in somebody's house. So I went there, and actually the most inexplainable part of my life, it was the next 2 months that I spent from April to May, or maybe even till July, where I sat in my brother's house, and he had a small kid, and I used to play. She's still my favorite, my niece. And I was just playing with her every day. I didn't attempt to get a job at all, because two conflicting thoughts were running in my head. One is, why will anybody give you a job? Not in a very negative way, in a very factual, clear-headed manner. I was thinking, I mean, nobody knows. You have no experience, and you're saying, I'm coming to Bombay. And I couldn't see any reason why anybody should give somebody like me a job. That was one. And the other thing was, you know, maybe I should do something about this, but I don't know what. Therefore, the thing happened that in these long conversations, the two of my friends in Delhi with this snail mail business, I think all of them, all the other students who were mostly in Delhi, and some of them were from Calcutta and somebody else from Bangalore, I think, they all had been placed, so to say. And a couple of my close friends got a little worried, more than me. And they went and told the course director that this guy is not doing anything, and, you know, why don't you speak to somebody? My course director spoke to somebody, and I got a letter in the mail from Shilpi Advertising saying that if you're interested in a copy test with us, please, I remember that language, contact the undersigned. That's what it said in that much officialese. And it had some Rock Pereira, the creative director of Shilpi, saying, you know, if you're interested, come, I can give you a copy test. So I went for a copy test, and it was a remarkable copy test. I mean, those days we had, I don't know what it is now, but we had lovely copy tests. You know, I quite enjoyed. I spent about two and a half hours in their office doing the copy test. It had questions like, you know, how will you explain how to tie your shoelaces to a blind man, for instance? That means you have to use only words to explain what you're supposed to do. And describe a spiral staircase in 50 words without using the word spiral or staircase, for instance. And so on. So, you know, very, very interesting thing. But one thing that caught my eye was the very last thing, which is an attached thing of proofreading. A page of maybe about 800 words with all deliberate mistakes and this and that. And for some reason, I was very good at that. Even though I did my MA in economics, and I needn't have been that specific or pedantic about the language, but I always was. I had that streak in me that somehow, if you're writing or doing it, do it very well. Don't write like an ass, or don't assume that you're good at something. You know, just make sure that at the very basics, the grammar is right. And after that, your content is correct or entertaining or whatever it's meant to do. It's a separate issue. But it's like your dress up or get up or whatever it is. Make sure that some basics are right about it. And of course, finally, people will judge you by the substance in any case. So I had that thing in me, and I wrote that, and I forgot about it and went back. Within about 10 days, I got another letter in the post saying that, regarding your application for copywriter, can you come and meet the undersigned? So I went and met that gentleman, oldish, very old, polished gentleman, and excellent English copywriter. Some of those people of those days were practically, you know, they were excellent. They were seriously excellent.
Yeah.
So he made me sit down, and I think I told you this before, and that's why you got the idea also of this whole business of proofreader, because I was thinking if he's calling me, I had enough sense to know that he wouldn't call me all the way and tell me you're not getting this. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So I knew that I had got the job. So all I was thinking in my mind, how much money should I ask? And I somehow decided, I think I should ask for 1,000 rupees. I have no idea. I thought four figures. 1,000 rupees is a big, big sum. And just ask who. Let's see. I mean, at the most, what will happen? He'll say no. So let's see. That was the only idea I had about that interview. And when I met Rock, and he looked at my test, he had brought out the test, and he said he liked first thing that he did was to go to that last page, and he said, this proofreading, and he showed me that he had written with pencil, he had ticked all those little places, and he had written zero defect, and not seen this kind of a test in a long while. So you're very good at it. Normally, and then he said, normally people miss this and miss that and miss that, but you've done this, whatever. I was more eager to know, what about all that creative stuff before? I've written pages and pages of stuff. And he said, yeah, okay, that was nice, this was nice. And he didn't pay that too much. In his mind, maybe because they had a lot of these public issue offering kind of clients. So for him, this proofreading was this probably, was... now I didn't in retrospect, then I didn't know. So he
you
was
were literally
really...
manna from heaven.
True. I can see that now. But at that stage, I was a little underwhelmed to see, why is he reacting less than, so? I mean, I put in a lot of effort and I thought it was nice. It was pretty creative and nice and light, nice imaginative answers. But his focus was on this whole copywriting business. I mean, sorry, the proofreading business. And yeah. He kept on and on about it. And then he said, how much do you expect to be paid? So since I was prepared, I said, I want 1,000 rupees. So he said, no, I have your package ready. And he showed it to me. And then he said, listen, it's not exactly coming to 1,000. Because after the deduction for this, that and the other, you will be getting 975 in your hand. But if you take it with the cash that we will be giving you for library books or something like that, it'll come to 1,012 or something like that, he said. Some number just above 1,000. So I thought, wow, I mean, this is working. Like, and he had already had the thing in there. It had nothing to do with my asking. Sorry.
No, I'm saying that the universe almost conspired, I said. Right from
this
the...
This is something that keeps happening. And of course, it also conspires against, but it sort of evens out.
Yeah.
It was one of those times when somebody actually had that. So that is how I got my first job. And what happened in the first 6 months was basically, I was and I was not called a trainee copywriter. I somehow hold that as a matter of great pride, because I know that since everybody comes in as a trainee first, and then they become a junior writer, and then they become a copywriter, and then they become a senior copywriter, and so on. And I was not called a trainee copywriter. I was called copywriter. There's no junior training. Straight away. So that whatever that formal letter that you got as the letter of appointment appointed me as a copywriter in Shilpi Advertising. And for some reason, I boasted to my brother saying, see, they're not calling me trainee. And he was in Atomic Energy or something. In something. He had nothing, no idea of anything of this. So he said, yeah, okay, fine, cool, whatever you say. So that way, that was a learning experience in terms of, you know, checking reams and reams of copy. Because those days, these public issue, I mean, people may not know these days, but a lot of what is called IPO now, I think. But there, the government required you to do a certain kind of declaration of all kinds of information. Therefore, many companies were forced to take out huge newspaper full-page ads, which means that contained, what, maybe 20,000 words sometimes of the closely written copy. But it's all handset. And therefore, you know, and you couldn't afford to make mistakes. Like not some one, agencies, yes. This silly mistake of a public issue without the letter L, which means, you know, something else altogether. And, you know, therefore, there were terrified people in agencies where you didn't want those kind of idiotic mistakes to happen. Yeah. After the senior people and the copywriter and Rock himself had checked it, it would come to me for a final check. So I was given this privilege of, you know, has Narayan signed this stuff?
Okay.
So, I mean, me a bit of an important kind of stuff to do, but it's very tedious. I mean, I know that I still love proofreading. I still like it. It's a lovely thing to do, to be careful about one's P's and Q's and all the rest of that. But it was tedious. I mean, you can't do it for 6 months like that.
It is tedious.
Yes. Yeah. So at some point, I mean, I also got some campaigns to do, and it all went off well. So that was what my first job was, mostly proofreading and some creative work and being called copywriter rather than a trainee.
But by this time, I think apart from a change of agency, you were fairly clear that advertising is where you wanted to be. That didn't change.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was pretty clear, because when I made friends and I was figuring out what people were... See, for me, I don't know, maybe for everybody it is, I don't know. For me, money was quite an important thing. So I couldn't at one level believe that they pay you for this. See, it's, I don't know if it's snacks of naivete or arrogance or what, I don't know. But I was thinking,
yeah,
they give you money to do this. This is not that hard. I mean, I was yet to meet all the multinational clients and this and that. All that comes in the future. Yeah. But in the first 1 or 2 years, this feels like this is money for jam. I mean, you're just doing something which is happy and, you know, there is nothing much to really strive and struggle and all that. This comes naturally and there are other people around and you get company and you can sit with the art guys and figure out things. And it was, and working late was not a problem. And, you know, I was also unmarried and it is all a sort of a nice thing to be happening. And then to think that, wow, man, somebody is paying you for this. You felt like you were conning somebody kind of thing. And why not? And if there's somebody wants to pay me for this, fantastic. So, yes, therefore, I think I fell in love with advertising, not so much for this or that. It was basically that I could earn money and good money at that. When I asked senior writers how much they were earning and then creative directors, and they would say, not just me, this is what I'm earning, but somebody's earning that much. I would say, what? They paid this kind of money to that guy? Wow. So which means I could see that in 4 or 5 years, I could very well be earning that kind of money. And I did too. And it was always, and I've never felt that I needed more. At every stage in my life till even now, I used to feel vaguely that I'm being overpaid. I don't know if that is a common thing among other people or not.
You must be that rare.
I'm standing somewhere and they are paying me and I've never asked for a raise ever. I've never asked for a raise ever because I didn't need to. I don't know. I felt they were paying quite a lot. And every time you changed, they gave you 20% more, sometimes 25% more once or twice. And then you said, okay, cool. I mean, so there was no, I don't remember negotiating with anybody. I don't or maybe at the end of the day, you know, once you have a certain amount of money, my temperament has always been, it's enough. I mean, I wanted the, that money to fund my travel and, you know, various hobbies at various points in time. But otherwise, it was okay. I had no complaints about on the money front.
So how did the next move happen?
See, I was about almost to the date I was there from for a year in Shilpi in Bombay. And there was a call. And, you know, there is the studio man. It's like a line of artists with their art boards in front of them. No longer a site. Nowadays, everybody has...
No longer the case. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so people of a certain generation may know that there were these boards and there were these half-broken blades, Bharat blades for cutting and thing. And therefore, they had cardboards underneath so that the blade didn't cut through and spoil the wooden furniture.
And the smell of that solution. There was some solution.
I can remember that smell. And yeah, and they had to paste the artworks and all that. So there were a line of 4 or 5 artists in the line that I sat. I sat at the very back and there was a Hindi copywriter and somebody else and then me. And to my left was the very senior copywriter whom I know to this day. This row went on about 8 or 9 deep. And at the end sat the master of the whole thing, which was the studio manager who was in most agencies the very, very powerful guy, you know. The accounts guys dreaded to go to these kind of guys because they were the traffic managers. And they'd say, no. Tell your client this, get out. I don't do all this thing here. You know, they would say anything. And because they were very good at their jobs, they couldn't be touched. And they generally knew everything. His name was Mr. Malum. Everybody's was, you know, it was a advertising agency. So everybody was encouraged to call. Even as a trainee, I could call the MD of the agency who was a Roger Pereira. And everybody called him Roger. And there was this Rock who was called Rocky. And so on with Nandita. And so everybody was, although they were all they were all very senior people to me. Everybody was called by their name, but the studio manager was Mr. Malim. You never said Malim to him. I don't know why.
You don't play around with that.
Very, very forbidding. So now Mr. Malim was the guy with the black telephone and he got a call. He said, Narayan. So I was sitting. I hadn't given the number to anybody. So, you know, there's no reason for me to give the studio manager's number to anybody at all. So I thought it could be mistaken. I went there and there was somebody who was saying, you know, I'm the finance director or somebody. It was Mrs. Sista of the Sista's organization, which later on became Sachi. Okay. And she said, I've heard about you from somewhere, something. We are looking for a senior writer for our Bangalore office for Sista's. Would you be interested? So I said, yes, just on the spot. I mean, I hadn't thought of anything, but if somebody's calling, I don't know. I didn't know why I should say no. And Bangalore seemed like a nice city. I'd never been to Bangalore before. Okay. And I was by myself, I mean, of course, with my brother and family. Right. But otherwise, there was nothing much. So, and I was sure that obviously there'll be more money. They're calling you, they'll give you something more. And so I said yes on the phone. And I put it down and Mr. Malum said, you got a job offer. That man knew everything. You couldn't get past him. So I said, no, what makes you think that? Boss, I've been here. I know all that. So I told him, Mr. Malim, you are mistaken this time, or something like that. I said, and I walked away. And I was thinking, this man is some magician or some, I don't know what he was. Obviously, he's been there for years. He's given enough of these phone calls to people from strange people asking for things. So,
but how did it land up at his? Normally, the receptionist would get it, right? How does it end up at Mr.?
So I don't know why it didn't. The receptionist phone, I can understand, because you could get it off the phone book. I don't know if people know that there used to be a telephone book which was this
exactly.
You can kill somebody if you threw it at their head or something. It's no longer there, but those kind of books were available. And if you searched under S and you turn the pages, you could read Shilpi advertising and you could call that number. It was freely available. But for some reason, somebody had bought that creative department, which was attended to by Male. So that's the way. And then I went and met Mrs. Sister, and she said, I can give you this package offer and all. It was some 2.5 times what I was earning then, even after an increment from Shilpi at the end of 1 year. So there was nothing for me to think. I said, yes, I'm going now. So.
Yeah. No, I'm saying one thing that's missing from everything that you've said so far is something that young people today face an enormous amount of, which is pressure on the job. You talk to anyone and they're at stress, but you're breezing through.
It appears like that. I know that it probably appears like that. I think about it sometimes. There must have been stressful days. It is just that I know I've come across people later on in my career also, and I feel that the way I could have been, and I have been useful to many of these people, is to encourage them to get a life of their own outside of the office, goddammit. That's all has been my
absolutely.
Nothing is worth that much. See, once I know that my money needs are met and I have a job, that's about it. Like my wife's mother, she used to tell my wife long ago, before I came into their lives, that when you come back from office, she told her daughter, like you discard your shoes or slippers at the doorway, leave your work there when you enter the house. I thought that is a very sensible way of looking at it.
Very sensible advice.
Probably more valid even today, because people are so tied up in their own definitions and identities and whatnot. Why should it's something you do for money. It doesn't mean that, you're disrespecting it. It doesn't mean all. I worked on some of the better campaigns and all that. I really don't want to get into all that. But some probably very, very big brands that all of you guys know, I've worked on all of that. So it's not like I was shirking and actually scamming people and taking money and doing nothing. I was not that. I was giving my 100%. And I've done my hard yards. I've done my midnight oil and all the rest of that. So there is
all that you have.
But I was also doing other things. This was not the be-all or end-all. I have... Yep. Absolutely. This is one thing that used to strike me those days in my mid-career when I used to be sent to Amsterdam or New York or whatever, some conference, this or Hong Kong, especially the Europeans and the Americans. And the thing that to learn from them, even if we had a project during a normal work day as a workshop, there would be, you are put with three other strangers. So 20 people in a room, say the creative directors from different countries are all meeting together. There's some one head honcho holding the workshop and saying, why don't you guys take a theme of, water scarcity in the world or some such thing, or women's issues or something, and come up with something. And so you'll all be separated into 4 or 5 groups, etc. So everybody was new to everybody. And you're given just 30 minutes or 20 minutes sometimes to do this part of the exercise, that part of the exercise and all that. And it was quite, on the one hand, nervous, it made you feel. But on the other hand, it was also energizing because you're meeting with other people from different countries, but essentially the same kind of, and you find out that it's just about the same thing everywhere. It's not like, they are sharper, better, greater or anything. It's the same thing do. Yeah, but the striking point was everybody was exactly finishing at 20 minutes because at 5:30, they are in this beach resort. They want to go out surfing. They want to go out swimming. They want to go out something. They've got their girlfriends or boyfriends or the significant other or whatever it is. And they want to get out.
Right.
Whereas for us Indians, I'm thinking, man, this is I don't have anything to do. I mean, this foreign country, I don't swim, and I don't certainly surf. I don't do anything of these things these guys do. So I was waiting for dinner, eat food, read some book, and go to sleep. So when you come back to India, of course, I had a lot of hobbies. But when you come back to India, I used to tell all these guys, just get a life of you, be interested in something else, so that you don't think most of the Indians think, but the evening is there, no. Night is there, no. So therefore, you know, the whole day they waste. They don't do anything much because to the back of their heads, they know, are 7 o'clock means 8 o'clock. And
yeah.
It's there, yeah. Kind of. So, yeah, I mean, some companies,
exactly.
You stay up to 8 o'clock, you also get dinner on the house. So, right. You know, all these right. kind of systems, because you don't have anything yeah. else to do. And especially the younger people who are not married and they have no particular things. And sometimes even the guys who supposedly had these responsibilities, some of work was all, it turned out, they probably didn't intend it to be that way. But work consumes them completely. Therefore, their friends, who are their friends? Their friends are at the workplace.
Yeah.
You know, we used to have yeah. friends in the house and the colony where we stayed.
Right.
Of course, you also need some friendships when you're working. But friendships at work are at some level competitive, I think. It's not pure friendship in practice. Whereas, you know, if you're at your home friends, somebody is an accountant. Somebody is doing something else completely. So you
yeah,
won't tell
them, like,
got rejected, man. My client got, you know, damn angry and all that. The girl listened to you and say, I said, let's go eat some chaat or something. So they don't understand you. And it's a nice thing. If you tell your yeah. colleague that this guy, this client behaved badly, you're going to get significant stories from right. them, two times better and two right. times worse. So it never ends. Therefore, I always tell people, work has its place. Please keep that in mind.
It has its place, yeah. What is your method, or did you arrive at a way of getting an idea? Did you ever think that, oh, I have to crack it by this time and this is what? So did you have certain ways of working, of taking the brief and then seeing how you would come up with the idea?
See, the thing is, between various clients, especially when you work with multinationals like Unilever and Procter & Gamble then, and even Godrej and the more Tatas, a certain kind of... what shall I say, enlightened companies with a lot of layers and of management and this and that, they had processified this whole business of giving briefs. So which means that, you know, even their managers and product managers and all that were supposed to get some internal approvals, and therefore there was a system to it. And therefore there was also a system of evaluating advertising that, you know, does the creative, you know, it's like a non-creative person's way of appraising creative. You know, it's like, having a checklist. Is it surprising? Is it this? Is it brief? Is it something? Will my target? So it was all that. And then you did one checklist kind of stuff. That is on the one hand. On the other hand, you could meet businessmen who just went by gut. And you said, I like that. Let's go with it kind of stuff. Or
yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, you know. So then there was a in between kind of. So there was a whole range of completely processified guys. So you learn to work with, for example, when I used to work with De Beers and... it was a very, very British stultified system of saying this brand is like this. All over the world, it will use shadows, which was a creative technique of only showing not real people, but only showing shadows. So if a couple were to meet each other and embrace or something, then it would happen as shadows on the floor. Because, I mean, there was a reason it was all in black and white, and then the diamonds stood very well against black and white. So there was an aesthetic reason for doing that. But no need to make it a rule, because in somewhat emotional countries like Asia and in, for example, Mexico and a few other countries, emotion sells. And, you know, these kind of, you can't design shadows and say that, you know, you've got something happening in India. So I had to fight with them for about 2 years, but they got it. And we did the shadows. We did the shadows to be, you know, because okay. you have to do it also and tell them. Yes. And within the shadows, I made the Indian gesture of a bride bending down in shadow form to touch the elder's feet, her own father or whatever. And all those little Indian things we introduced, and the music was there. But I told them, listen, you can go far more than this. They went by numbers and research in a big way, not silly research and not over small sample sizes, really serious, big quality and quantity they used to do. They understood the point. In 2 years, they changed around. India was one of the very few countries where we started using. We still stuck to black and white, of course. Because it actually shows up the diamond without any distracting colors.
Yeah,
but we had real distracting, and the stories became something else. And of course, we used Aishwarya Rai for the first time before she became the Aishwarya Rai in the launching of Nakshatra Diamond. Huge success. Yeah. And it took off all places, some place like Coimbatore on the map, the sales map of the world sales map. There was a New Delhi, and there was a Mumbai, and there was a Hong Kong, and there was Japan, and there was some place in, I mean, Tokyo and some place, Shanghai, and of course, New York and all those places. Suddenly there was one, Coimbatore. One of the directors there was asking me when we went for some briefing or some campaign presentation, where is this Coimbatore or something? So they were very surprised. So,
so
but suddenly this nakshatra changed their fortunes.
Okay.
So therefore, the process depended on different clients and working with them, and then working as a team within and saying, you know, can we, because our job is to one, accept, not to be rude, to accept what it is.
Yeah.
But don't accept it 100% because something is telling you that, you know, we can go further than this. There's nothing wrong with this, but surely we can go further than this. And therefore, you give them an alternative way, which feels better. And sooner or later, I find people listen to it. More often than not, people are reasonable because you're not, they understand that you're not doing that creative tantrum bit. Nobody wants that. You know, I'm creative and I say you. It's not that kind of
So that's an amazing bit of, I think even though you were bound by processes, you never sort of allowed that to become kind of wall that was erected in front of you. You sort of tried to get through to the client and then say, okay, make them understand why culturally something like this may not work here, rather than, you know, be definitive about it. No, this is not going to work. I'll tell you what works. You can't be absolutely sure. And like you said, it's a process of working through with the client. It would have meant taking one step at a time, coming back, because the client is going against the face of whatever, you know, his process is. So it's a long journey for them also to accept that something which has worked in other markets, I have to take this chance here, is not an easy thing to do.
So, yeah. So it took 2 years. In their case,
okay.
So sometimes, you know, you need to be. It's a long game. It's, you know, you need to sort of be patient, because you know where they are coming from. They have their disciplines. They are not doing it to spite you. They are not doing it to criticize your creative or anything like that. They are doing it because they have been there before, long before they met you. They had their own processes anyway set in place.
Right.
So just because they meet you, they don't have to change their whole system of working or something like that. The question of being a little realistic about these things. And I don't know, I probably was successful 60% of the time and not successful 40% of the time. You can't always win this.
So now that you've spent time, I'd like to now explore a bit about what it means to be a creative boss, because you started off as a writer. Then how do you ensure that you're able to give direction? Because ultimately you move towards creative director and, you know, up the ladder, and then your job is, how do you ensure that you get people to deliver and get them to understand what you're really looking for? How would you give feedback, for example?
Yeah, it's a very valuable or a very strong part of being a creative director, that you have to, one, make judgments, and second, it's not going to always be in the favor of the person. And I mean, because, you know, your allegiance is to the consumer finally, and not even to the client. I would say your allegiance is to the consumer finally, and certainly not to the people working under you. It doesn't mean you're ill-treating them or something, but they know that you are trying to evaluate on behalf. It is a responsibility like anything else. What helps, what I'm finding then, what I found then and what I found later also, is that if a creator, if a creative director with roughly, I don't know, 12 to 15 years of experience, who's gone through various brands, worked with various teams, both on the client side, inside, with very good planners, very good account directors, very good other creative people, you can go only so far singly and in the big brands. There are too many people involved in many of these decisions. It's very difficult to go too far just by yourself. So anybody with any creative director with 12 to 15 years of creative direction, I have a feeling with this kind of a background, will have a certain amount of, what shall I say, gravitas. They can look at an idea submitted by anybody and they look at it and say, no man. It's not arrogance. It's not anything. That experience comes all into that moment. So I would take anybody with 15 years experience or 20 years experience or whatever, with honest experience of working on brands and stuff. And then that means you've been through those struggles. You've been through those late nights. You've been through those difficult clients. You've been through all those phases. And if I can judge in 10 seconds and if I can tell somebody, no boss, this is not going to work. I don't know. There's a chance that it may still work. I don't know. But if I say so, or if anybody in that position says so, I would listen to them. Because they are not saying it just like that. It is coming from somewhere. It's coming from their own experience. That is one part. The other part, which I've not really shared with anybody, okay, one first for Venu's podcast maybe, is that this thing about having an internal evaluation, which I always for some reason kept secret. I don't know why this. It is to do with, you know, as an observation, as when I was in school, I don't know, I wrote about it last year sometime on LinkedIn about, you know, the invention of what do you call those nicknames for other students and teachers, especially by schoolboys. And I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 people may have read it. So I'll take the liberty of assuming nobody's really read it. And there I had gone through this thing of saying that kids are very inventive. They are, of course, cruel. So I won't get into the ethics part, yeah. of whether it's right to nickname somebody or not. I'm coming in from purely the creative aspect of how some people can do this kind of nicknaming and other people can't. And that's a good sign, for example. Like we had a kid in school, I don't know, when we were very young, know who used to for some reason keep sweating profusely much after the games period was over, and all, he used to keep sweating, his face was always glistening, and some local genius in that class called him Dalda, which is of course a vanaspati which also glistens, and it's some cheaper substitute for ghee or something like that, very common in many middle class homes. I mean, at one it pokes fun, it brings them down, but the thing is, he didn't have to explain, everybody knew that guy. In fact, I remember his face after so many years, but I don't know what his real name was. The word Dalda stuck to him like that. So as we went from 48 to 9, same school. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So his name became that. And therefore, the fact that I don't know who that fellow was who coined this, but that is, I'll connect this up with what I mean by creative evaluation in a second or in a minute. But that was, so let's say Dalda is the first example. Second example was, there was a Sanskrit teacher of ours who lived a little further away across the playground in front of our school. And then behind it was a rubbish dump. And to the right of it and left of it was also a continuous municipal rubbish dump of some kind. And the city used to deposit all its plastic bags and paper and waste and all kinds of nonsense used to be piled up over there. And this guy lived, beyond that was the main road that went across. And he lived in one of those lanes across the main road. So that Sanskrit professor used to take the shortcut of crossing that main road, getting into that dump, going past the playground and then entering the school. Otherwise, if he took the main road, he would have to go like that and come all the way around.
Kind of, okay.
Which would have meant another 15, 20 minutes. And he was already in his late 50s and had a big stomach and everything. And he had his dhoti and his cloth bag and all that. And he used to come down that dump. And as kids, around 10:30, 10:40, when a certain period ended and the next period was about to start, a few of us used to hang around in the back of the class where the window oversaw this whole expanse of rubbish. And we would see this guy almost religiously, walking over there. He would get down, see a mound of dirt, which was pretty solid, but there would be pieces of grass, damp grass, wet marsh. So every day, all that, the topography changed marginally. So he had to make a decision at every mound that, okay, now I will jump over there. And then he would jump on that. And then you say, okay, next one over there. And then you... So we would watch this guy, doing this, making these little decisions. And probably in 7-8 minutes, he reached the school. And some guy chose to call him Armstrong. This was a reference to Neil Armstrong of that first man in the moon fame. Where they did that little hopscape on the moonscape.
Yeah.
That is the second example. That was brilliant. And the thing about either this Dalda or this or Armstrong, or the third one I'll tell you shortly, is that that guy didn't have to explain. It is lateral enough, but he didn't have to say, I'm calling him Armstrong, because if you have to explain a creative idea, it's not a creative idea. When you say it, enough people say, hey, I get it, and they start laughing. Then you know that it's working. I'm seeing something and I'm hearing you saying, I'm sort of saying, wow, brilliant. That perfectly described. Like I said, I'm not getting into the ethics of whether we should be nicknaming or whether it's really cruel or not to be able to, address your elders as such. That's a separate subject. I'm not getting it. I'm looking at it purely from the creative angle of
purely having from, a place.
So the third example was when I was talking about this during a cricket match to a fellow player from another school, that guy laughed at when I told him they call him Armstrong. And he gave me an example of somebody they had. It was a Tamil teacher of some kind who used to wear that dhoti tied in that very traditional way with that, in the form of loose pajamas that goes, something goes between the legs and it's in the back and all that. And that guy had, during some part of that class, he kept bending down. And maybe that part of the dhoti was going over some itchy part of his ankle or something. So he used to go down and then scratch his ankle, come up. And he used to go down, scratch his ankle and come up. And some guy from that moment named him Auto Rickshaw. Okay, now this will only make sense to people maybe before 2000s when the self-starter and the auto rickshaw were not there.
That's exactly. Yeah.
So this was, there was a solid metal rod at the bottom of next to the driver. And if you got inside in that man, turned that meter and all that, and he bent down and he yanked it twice or thrice or before to get it started.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then, you know, the whole class burst out laughing when this guy said after the guy had gone, not in his earshot, of course. So if I take these three examples, if you look at Dalda first, I mean, if I want to seriously look at it,
yeah.
Then if I look at Dalda first, then it's the glistening of the face versus some kitchen item at home.
Right.
Okay, you made a connection between two really unconnected things, somebody's face glistening and some oil that glistens at cooking at home. So from somebody's face to cooking, you've covered a distance. So we can call that laterals. To my mind, that seems like, okay, if a creative guy can come up with those kind of ideas, maybe he earns a salary. Fine, good. I think
right.
we can pay him. It's good. He must be able to do at least that much. On the other hand, if somebody was periodically or very regularly doing the Armstrong ones, where somewhere, you know, you look at one guy walking in some landscape and can go all the way to the moon and say this resembles something, the distance is even further between some astronomical detail and some playground in front of you. And if somebody is making those kind of, that means the distance of the jump is much further than the distance between the face and the cooking oil, for instance. This is really far out. Then you say, man, watch out. Maybe this guy deserves a promotion if this guy or girl or whoever is doing that kind of stuff. Then you say, wow, that's good. So I used to, and if somebody went auto rickshaw, that is brilliant. I mean, that is like absolutely, I mean, somebody is scratching their ankle and you can connect it with some, you know, we know teachers, we know their dresses, we know their habits on the one hand, and we've all traveled at an auto rickshaw and at another time completely unconnected. So therefore, this business of connecting unconnected worlds and the distance of the unconnected worlds matters in creative work. The further people can travel, and some people, I don't know why, but some people are able to do this better than other people. Yeah. And I'm not a sociologist or psychologist or something, so I don't know the process why some people are able to do it, others. I take it as they come. When these people do it and the distance is huge, is better, then in my mind, I always evaluate. This is the secret I was telling you that. You know, I always, even my own ideas, the next day, at the time of creating any idea, everything seems fantastic in any case within the next 5 minutes. But when you give it some cool off time and see it the next morning, you feel like, what was I thinking? So sometimes your own ideas and other people's ideas, I've noticed that, is this a, you know, Dalda kind of idea? Is this a Armstrong kind of idea? Or is it really an auto kind of idea? Because many people think that being lateral is what it's all about. It's not. It has to also make sense. Which means the clarity must be so clear. Like I said earlier, if other people, you have to explain, see, I'm calling it an auto rickshaw because, you know, then it doesn't work. It's no longer a creative. Creative idea means you went far, you did the distance, but the listener makes no effort in understanding what you're intending. So basically, it's your hard work or your thinking or whatever it is of finding that lateral connection. But the connection is made simply. That's why, you know, I don't care for people who can make just lateral connections. It doesn't make any sense. You know, I can think of this and I can think of that. That is rubbish.
Right.
You still have to solve some problem, deliver some promise. It still makes sense somewhere. So therefore, that has its own kind of clarity. So I have always been on the one hand telling people, be clear what you want to say. And on the other hand, the opposite thing of saying, listen, go far away from the direct kind of clarity. Find some imaginative way of being clear. Anyway, I've been taking maybe too much of the time.
No, that's brilliant. I think this is one of those deep lessons. And I hope somebody who's listening understands this. You're not simply saying an idea should be good, better, best. You're actually giving people reasons on or ways in which they can evaluate something and then figure out where it goes next. So from whatever you've just told me, I think there's an element of culture. There's an element of context. And there's an element of shared experiences.
True.
So if it goes across all of these things, then to a large extent, you can tell people, hey, I get it. I can use that shorthand in a film scene. I can use it in a press ad. I can use a sound from one of these things. Just start that off and then say, okay, you know, I'm just exploring where this thing could go. Explore how somebody who's into advertising actually decides that he wants to learn Ruby on Rails, which if I was told learn a programming language, I'd run 100 miles in the other direction. I'm very happy exploring things that I understand. But if it means that I have to put in, I have to understand another foundation altogether. So how does one get to that?
Yeah, I think these kind of things are the many things that, you know, you don't really plan for. At least in my life, it's been like that. I've just stumbled into things. So this programming business is also one of those things. Maybe there's a background to it, if at all it means anything. Somewhere in the 90s, you know, America was flooded. This is the pre-Apple, pre-Microsoft days of early days of home computers of the computers were there, but they were in offices. Computers being at home was not yet a thing then. And there used to be these reduced versions of something called Commodore 64 in the US and an Amiga something or the other. They were not popular in India, but there was a British equivalent at that time in the late 80s, early 90s called ZX Spectrum. And that was a small computer. And we had a client called Computer Point, which was launching its
Computer Point, I remember this campaign. Yeah.
So, and then we got into it. And then, you know, me and a friend got into it so much that we used to play those very simple, oddball, but extremely addictive games. And in the name of telling the client, no, we have to understand the product and all that kind of stuff. We used to land up in their office and with only the security guard there, play till 1 o'clock in the night and all that mad times. But we used to play. And therefore, then later on, I bought one also. And it was there at home. And then I bought books about what it is. And then I realized that one of the things besides games and little things that it could do stuff like, you know, your home accounts and very simple stuff. And it taught you the basic language, as in BASIC, all caps. It meant some acronym, I think.
Yeah.
And that was a language before. I think it was there with COBOL and all those languages that are no more anywhere. And so I had something I must have read somewhere. I said, let me try. And I used to write very basic programs. You could make one little dot move from right side of the screen to the left side of the screen because you put in some little code and all that sort of thing. I found it fascinating. If I had thought to myself that this is maths and arithmetic, I would have stopped. But for some reason, it didn't feel like that. It felt more like logic and stuff. And therefore, I got it. So maybe there was some background there. Because when I came to around 2010, and Apple, I was a Mac user from around 2001 till today. And therefore, I think I used their web program. It was called something then. And that again had this aspect of programming and creating stuff on your own. And Apple, of course, made everything so easy. And then I got into something called Drupal, which was actually a content management system, which is there till today. And of course, WordPress beat it hollow, and now WordPress exceeds it. And of course, the Drupal aficionados say that WordPress is just a blogging platform and all that, but it's not. WordPress is today a proper content management system, as much as Drupal is. And somewhere while Drupal was there, I'm not sure where it happened. Like I said, I stumbled upon Ruby on Rails. But given my background of not being a stranger to this field, I read some book on, actually a printed book ordered from Amazon, and said, what's this all about? And I felt, this is sheer logic. It's a very, very beautiful language. And I said, I can pick this up. Within a month, I was there. And the next 3 months, I devoted 2-3 hours after lunch every day at office, not to meeting clients, not for looking at work, but to just create a program. I just became a little mental about it. And I started doing stuff to create a workflow, not the financial workflow, but workflow. You know, when the client briefs, what are the suggestions, what is the meeting, who's the person handling it, how does it go through the account system, which copywriter, which art director, who's the studio guy, when does the invoice go, when does the estimate come, and sort of side that at some point it went off into the financial accounting of the accounts guys and all that. It was a very elaborate program, all written in Ruby on Rails over the next 3 months. And we used it for 3-4 years. It was called metalbackstage.com. And then it had only internal usage. So it came about, it seems like a surprising thing if you look at it like that, but if you look at the various steps taken at various times, it seemed to have fallen in place. And then suddenly I stopped everything and said from 2018, somewhere there, I said, WordPress is it. And I've been doing a lot of WordPress. I love it. So.
Okay, wonderful. If there is a young person getting into copywriting today, so a lot of people think that it's full of pressures. It's full of, you know, there's no fun in the job. Whereas when you and I joined, I don't think we ever looked at this as, like you said, someone is actually paying you to do it. So what would you look at? How would you look at, describe advertising to someone today in the context of today's world?
See, the thing is, whether it's today or yesterday, the value of a good advertising creative person or even a servicing person or whatever lies in their exposure to life outside of advertising. You don't become a good advertising by advertising guy by studying more advertising. Now, that may be true of in civil engineering or some other fields where you know, learn more of civil engineering and you become a better civil engineer, I presume. I don't know anything about the subject, but not in copywriting and in creative direction and in artwork and in creating creative ideas for a brand. You have to have a life of your own. You should know how people are. You should know what aunts say to aunties, you know. Like once I actually saw a woman looking at herself because some in the reflection of a glass, just as an example, where because some guy in a shop where I was visiting, that the shopkeeper called her auntie. And she looked at herself at her own reflection in the mirror. Now that I made into a thing for an ad for Godrej dye, for hair dye, for example. Have you become an auntie too soon? You know, is that first trans of when did I become an auntie? You know, those kind of things. Therefore, if you're observing life around you, there is enough happening. But if you just say, I'm studying ads to become a better ad person, it doesn't work. Of course, you need to learn the craft, all that. But I would say just get out of it. Just go on travel, do something else, find out something else. Get out of yourself. Get out of your head. Go and see how the world lives. How your uncles and aunties are, how your friends are, what elders are all about, what is the 60 plus thinking, whatever. I mean, get out, find out, be curious. Like Dorothy Parker said, the best cure for, she said, the cure for boredom is curiosity, and there is no cure for curiosity. So,
Linda, I don't think I could have summed it up better, Naren. I don't think there is anything that I need to do to add to this. It's been an exhilarating conversation, and I'm so glad that you agreed to come on so early in the thing, because I would have loved to, we'll probably have you in again at a point when hopefully this thing will grow a little more and we'll take the other parts of your life. Okay.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.